just about 7 o'clock. So before we get started, I'll just say that if you have a completed card to turn in from the second module, How to Meditate, I'll take that. If you were not here last week, there's a handout at the back of the class that's about this module, Module 3, Presenting the Path, and so that's just information that you need for this class. If you're filling out the completion form, then those will be available after class, but I don't want to confuse everybody who's not filling out the form and trying to get their certificate. If you have any questions about that, you can just ask me, but I'll mention that we provide these classes without charge so that we don't have any obstacles for you guys coming to class. This time of year, wrapping up on January 31st, we are doing our annual appeal, which means that we're trying to get a response from anybody who plans on volunteering, who plans on contributing financially to the center. So if you come on Sundays, we've been going over that, but if you haven't and you have any questions about that, there's a form you can fill out, some stuff to do online. And you can always contribute any week that you're here with cash in the box or a check, or we have this really awesome text giving, which you can see as you walk out the door. You do it one time, and then it gets your information, and then it's literally as simple as sending a text, and then your credit card gets charged. So, any questions? All right.
It's maybe a few more people coming. We'll wait another minute or two. I don't know how many people have ever been to a Zen temple or a Theravada temple, but they're usually pretty, like, not a lot of color. And then Tibetan temples are like, you know, it's like technicolor, different styles of practice. Well, we're going to do some traditional prayers. I really don't know where the refuge in Bodhicitta is. Oh, yes, I do. Page 34. Yeah, in the Gold Book. And we'll talk about these. You can think of, now here, I'm going to say a couple of things about ritual. Well, let's say a couple of things about the books, because I think this is important too. That, you know, is we call it Dharma etiquette, and we think of the books, the text, anything that has Dharma teachings written on them as something precious, because the words in these books have the potential to liberate us from suffering and to guide us to supreme enlightenment. So hey, that's more valuable than money. And so we really want to treat it with respect. So as part of that, the mindfulness practice that we want to be aware of, just anything that's valuable, you don't put it on the floor, do you? You know, this is an Asian tradition too. You don't step on books, and also books were really precious and hard to come by back in the day, but you don't put them on the floor, you don't step over them or on them, and you know, you try to treat them with respect. That's the main mindfulness practice that we need to remind ourselves of with any of these texts, and with the things, our notes that we're taking, things like that. I always get twisted, you know, whenever I get stuff in the mail, Buddhist mailings, I go, what do I do with this now, you know, because I have to treat it with respect. Anyway, so you can think of the prayers as like planting seeds. Just simple. As simple as that. We're just planting seeds in our mind that will ripen at some point in the future. And we're going to do maybe on page 34 we'll do refuge and bodhicitta, all of this in English, four immeasurables, and then the seven limb prayer. And I'll explain, you know, maybe tonight I'll say something about refuge and bodhicitta, and then I'll explain that the next week, the four measurables, and the next week I'll say a few words about the seven limb prayer. But refuge and bodhicitta, refuge is there's a whole module in Tibetan in discovering Buddhism on Buddhist refuge, and so refuge would be like, if there's a if there's a hailstorm and you're out in the middle of a field, and you know there's a building, where are you going to go? Where are you going to go for refuge? You're going to go to that building for safety, you know, to protect you. So we, you know, refuge is like, from a Buddhist perspective, it's a pretty big deal, because it's like relating to the Buddhas, the enlightened beings, and our own potential to be enlightened, and the Dharma, that is not only the text, but the realization of the text and our potential to gain those realizations, and the Sangha, or the spiritual community, the people that are our helpers along the way, and our potential to be that for others. So, you know, the Buddha's like the doctor, and the Dharma's like the medicine, the Sangha's like the nurse, like that. So we have that kind of a notion about going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. But the motivation for going to refuge is twofold. It could be three, particularly in the Tibetan tradition. The first one is confidence. Well, first of all, you know, most of us here are new to Buddhism, so you don't have confidence yet. And you may never, if you don't do the practices, you may never be able to say that this particular path works for you. If you do the practices and try to be mindful of what you've learned during the day, when problems arise and so on, and you're able to rescue yourself from a difficult situation, you go, wow, that's that worked. And you get confidence. So confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, confidence particularly in the Dharma, that's the ultimate refuge. And then the other one is dread. And that the dread, it's, you know, it's sort of like, I like the word dread, sometimes it's fear, but it's sort of, and I'm not going to give you the textbook definition of it, but it's sort of like just paying attention to our minds and realizing what how uncontrolled our mind is 99% of the time. I'm speaking from my own personal experience. Everybody else here might just, you know, I might be the other way around. You're all out of control 1% and in control 99%. But most of us have issues with our mind being like wild and out of control. And so the consequences, the karmic seeds that get planted by a mind that's out of control, that's totally motivated by self-centeredness most of the time, the karmic consequences are always going to be dismal. And so we don't want that. So we have to have some sort of dread for the karmic consequences of living with a mind that's wild, and some confidence that the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, that these teachings actually can deliver. This is the medicine, basically, that can help us solve our problems. And so I'm just giving it to you in a nutshell. But it takes time. It's a lifetime of practice. You know, I'm a student of Buddhism for a long time, and I still consider myself, you know, the practice of refuge is a practice of a lifetime, because when problems come, and they will, right? We all have to deal with them. I mean, the biggies are sickness and aging and old age and death. But there's a lot of stuff that happens in between. And when problems come, do we go to refuge to the top shelf at the liquor store? That's where the good stuff is, I heard. I don't know. Or do we go to, you know, the refuge to drug, sex, and rock and roll and anything else we can to distract ourselves? Or do we go to refuge to our own inner wisdom, you know, to the Dharma realizations that we gain through practice? You know, we can, something that's reliable, something that really can, that we can count on. So, enough said about that. So refuge is a big deal in Buddha Dharma. And by the way, you can come here. This is what I love about Buddhism. First time I heard about it, first time I heard this, I went, wow, I like that about Buddhism. And I wasn't even a Buddhist at the time, but this guy said, look, you can take it or leave it. You know, it's not, you don't have to be a Buddhist to be happy, and you don't have to be a Buddhist, period. And the Buddha said, listen to my teachings with a little bit of a mind of skepticism and a healthy skepticism, open-minded skepticism, I should say. And examine the teachings like if you were assaying gold, I don't know how you would do that, but you pour different things on it to see if it's really gold. And so you examine it through your own experience. And if it helps your mind, if it doesn't hurt you, if it doesn't hurt others, then you should, you know, consider adopting that way of thinking, or at least working with it a little bit. So, you know, the Buddha really, really encouraged us to examine the teachings through our own experience. Some things are more easy to prove than others, but a lot of it is what you might even say is common sense. All right, so enough of that. So the first two lines, I go for refuge until I'm enlightened. So the ultimate realization of our human potential is called enlightenment. And we go into the Buddha, that's the doctor, the Dharma is the medicine, and the Supreme Assembly are the skillful helpers or nurses. And then, so those first two lines would distinguish somebody who's a Buddhist from a non-Buddhist. And then the second two lines, by my practice of giving and other perfections. So there's six perfections of a bodhisattva. So this is the, now we're talking about the Mahayana path, is There's a generosity in ethics and patience and enthusiasm and concentration and wisdom. Those are the six perfections, but they only list one here. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So the first two lines distinguish a Buddhist from a non-Buddhist, and the second two lines distinguish someone who's practicing the great vehicle, the Mahayana vehicle, where we're striving for enlightenment in order to benefit all sentient beings. So we'll do this three times, and then we'll read through the four immeasurables, immeasurable love, compassion, joy, and equanimity, and then the seven limb prayer. Okay, so we'll do this together. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of others to the great enlightenment. Okay. Let's do a few minutes of meditation, just to calm down more than anything, and bring your attention to your breath. And that could be the sensation that, again, you can count it as we did last time, or you can just listen. A lot of people just focus on the sensation of the in and out breath at the tip of the nose, or the rising and falling of the abdomen, whatever is the most effective for you. And of course, when your mind gets distracted, which it inevitably will, you just bring it back again and again. You don't let your mind go off without disciplining it. you can relax, concentration. We found that after handing out all those nice things. Prayers, but you can download them too, right? But it's nice to have them at home. We don't want people to take these books out of here. But I mentioned there were two different prayers. Look on page 137 first. These are both considered to be sort of cryptic Lamrim texts. The 137. And without getting into too much detail about it, each of these prayers includes the three principles. You know, the second one's pretty obvious, but this one, even the foundation of all good qualities, it includes the three principles. It includes the three scopes that we talked about last time as well, which I'll review again tonight. But let's read through these just to have these imprints in our mind. And then we'll read, when we get to the three principles of the path, we'll read down through renunciation. I'll tell you when to stop. But let's just, you'll notice too that both of these texts are starting out with some sort of homage to the guru, to the teacher. Again, it's not just a feature of Tibetan Buddhism. It's a feature of all aspects of Buddhism. Teachers and, you know, qualified great teachers are amazing and great exemplars of the teachings, and they're precious. But the teacher really becomes important when we enter the Vajrayana or the tantric practices. So this whole text, both of these texts really are meant to prepare our mind to practice tantra. And so this is important from the very beginning. At least in this tradition, the Galupa tradition, we always teach about respect for and paying homage to and all those things to the qualified guru, or guru equals lama equals teacher. Same, you know, those words are pretty synonymous, but it's a teacher who's heavy with good qualities. That's one way they talk about the guru. All right, so we'll read the foundation here. By the way, those of you, if you're going to, you know, finish this course and get credit for it and everything, you have to memorize one of these. So, not that hard to do. The foundation of all good qualities is the kind and perfect pure guru. Correct devotion to him is the root of the path. By clearly seeing this and applying great effort, please bless me to rely upon him with great respect. Understanding that the precious freedom of this rebirth is found only once is greatly meaningful and difficult to find again. Please bless me to generate the mind that unceasingly, day and night, takes its essence. This life is as impermanent as a water bubble. Remember how quickly it decays and death comes. After death, just like the shadow follows the body, the results of black and white karma follow. Finding firm and definite conviction in this, please bless me always to be careful, to abandon even the slightest negativities, and to accomplish all virtuous deeds. Seeking sensoric pleasures is the door to all suffering. They are uncertain and cannot be relied upon. Recognizing these shortcomings, please bless me to generate the strong wish for the bliss of liberation. Led by this pure thought, mindfulness, alertness, and great caution arise. The root of the teachings is keeping the Pratimoksha vows. Please bless me to accomplish this essential practice. Just as I have fallen into the sea of samsara, so have all mother migratory beings. Have the responsibility of freeing migratory beings. Even if I develop only bodhicitta, but I don't practice three types of morality, I will not achieve enlightenment. With my clear recognition of this, please bless me to practice the bodhisattva vows with great energy. Once I have practiced distractions to wrong objects and correctly analyzed the meaning of reality, please bless me to generate quickly within my mind stream a unified path of calm abiding and special insight. Having become a pure vessel by training in the general path, please bless me to enter the holy gateway of the fortunate ones, the supreme Vajra vehicle. At that time, the basis of accomplishing the two attainments is keeping the pure vows and samaya. As I have become firmly convinced of this, please bless me to protect these vows and pledges like my life. Then, having realized the importance of the two stages, the essence of the Vajrayana, and by practicing with great energy, never giving up the four sessions, please bless me to realize the teachings of the Holy Guru. Like that, may the Gurus who show the noble path and the spiritual friends who practice it have long lives. Please bless me to pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. In all my lives, never separated from perfect Gurus, may I enjoy the magnificent Dharma. By completing the qualities of the stages and paths, may I quickly attain the state of Vajradhara. Did that solve it by taking it out of my pocket? Or no? Yeah. Well, I don't know. I'll switch if you want me to. What is this, some kind of echo?
Weird interference.
Name of my story of my life. No, that's fine.
Yeah, it's on.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. Okay. So now, we'll do the, we'll go down just through renunciation here. All right. So the first line, again, paying homage to the Gurus. I bow down to my perfect Gurus, the essential meaning, the victorious ones' teachings, the path praised by all the holy victors and their children, the gateway of the fortunate ones desiring liberation. This I'll try to explain as much as I can. Those who are not attached to the pleasures of circling, who strive to make freedom and endowments meaningful, who entrust themselves to the path pleasing the victorious ones, you fortunate ones, listen with a calm mind. Without the complete intention definitely to be free from circling, there is no way to pacify attachment seeking the pleasurable effects in the ocean of circling. Also, by craving for cyclic existence, embodied beings are continuously bound. Therefore, at the very beginning, seek renunciation. Freedom and endowments are difficult to find, and life has no time to spare. By gaining familiarity with this, attractions to the appearances of this life is reversed. By thinking over and over again that actions and their effects are unbetraying, and by repeatedly contemplating the miseries of cyclic existence, attractions to the appearances of future lives is reversed. And having trained that way, there is no arising, even for a second, of attraction to the perfections of cyclic existence, and all day and night the intention seeking liberation arises. Then the thought of renunciation has been generated. That's all right. Now we're going to stop there for the moment. We'll go back. We'll finish reading it at the end of the class. But I want to spend tonight, this week, and next week in particular, you know, focusing more on this topic of renunciation. So I defined renunciation last week a little bit. Anybody remember what I said? Ta-da. Well, we'll just wait until somebody raises it. Yeah, go ahead. Oh.
The spontaneous wish to free oneself from suffering.
The spontaneous, what'd you say, the wish?
Spontaneous wish to free oneself from suffering.
Yeah. Okay. I like that. This determination to be free, free from suffering. So again, I mentioned this to there's several implications in there in it. The spontaneous wish to be free from suffering implies what?
There is suffering.
Well, yeah, there is suffering, number one. And, pardon?
You know you're suffering.
You know you're suffering, yeah. And what, and it implies causes, but it also implies what else?
You can do something about it.
Yeah, that you can actually be free. I mean, it, like, you know, that it's possible to be free from suffering. Most, you know, it's like wanting, yeah, so, you know, being, everybody wants to be free from suffering, but is it possible to be free from suffering? And how, you know, is it, more importantly, is it possible for you, you know, me, individually? Or is it, you might think, well, somebody else, maybe the Dalai Lama or Lama Zopa or somebody else could do it, but, you know, not me. I'm just ordinary person with ordinary mind. You know, it's not, I don't have that capability. I think, you know, it's a good question, and it's something that we need to look at. We need to think about a lot, because, you know, I would say that most of us, I'm guessing, don't think we can, you know, we probably think we could dial it down a little bit. Kind of like thermostat, you know. We could lower the intensity of the suffering, but to be free, are you kidding me? I mean, that, and this is the claim of the Buddha Dharma, is that it's possible to not only dial it down and suffer less, but actually not suffer at all. That's a pretty profound assertion. But this is, you know, and this is what the Buddha taught in the first, in the Four Noble Truths. Remember, he talked about that. I don't think we talked about that last time, but you know, the first time he taught, George did a little bit. First time the Buddha taught got enlightened under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya, and he walked to Sarnath, which is a little town outside Varanasi, India, and he saw his old buddies and he taught them, his friends, these four truths. And the first one, it sort of goes like this. All worldlings are deranged. You know, we're all sick. You know, and if we don't get it, that we're sick, not much. There's no reason. Like if you're vomiting blood and you go, ah, there's nothing wrong. You're running 105 fever. Oh, there's nothing wrong. You know, you're having crushing pain radiating down the left arm. Oh, there's nothing wrong. You see what I'm saying? We have to be honest with ourselves and say, we are sick. There is a problem here. So that was the Buddha's first, you know, his first disciples. He taught them, you know, the truth of dukkha, We're going to go into this ad nauseum in future weeks. I want to say one thing about the truth of suffering, because I don't want people to get tubed by this. Because in Buddhism, we do a very in-depth study of dukkha, or a Sanskrit word, which I like the word dukkha better than suffering or unsatisfactoriness, or Geshe Gelug's favorite new term is complications or whatever. Anyway, it encompasses all kinds of like yucky things that we don't want, basically. And we'll talk a lot about it. Now, you can, you know, it's just like in life, you know, you can kind of go, oh my God, things are worse than I thought they were. Really. When we start talking about this and you start seeing when we start seeing maybe for the first time what a mess we're in, our mind is out of control and we're caught in this process of uncontrolled causation called samsara, and it goes on from lifetime to lifetime and on and on. It's pretty it can get you. It can really, you know, make you go, wow, this is not good. The point of this, though, is not for us to develop, to get paralyzed by it, but is to have compassion for ourselves, okay? This is really the essence of renunciation, is to recognize the situation that we're in for what it is. It is dukkha. And then wishing yourself to be free, having compassion for yourself. Now that, you know, that's different than, we had this conversation in some other classes about the difference between empathy and compassion, and they've even done scientific studies where, you know, in the healthcare profession, the burnout rate's like 60%+, because they call it empathy burnout. You know, people are seeing suffering and they wish them to be free from, I mean, they empathize with their suffering, and it kind of makes the mind of the caregiver unhappy. Whereas compassion should never make the mind unhappy. So wishing yourself to be free from suffering should buoy your mind up. It should make your mind happy. So compassion is always going to be a positive state of mind. And so here we are, we're going to be talking about all the different kinds of dukkha or unsatisfactoriness that we're going to have to deal with in life. And we want to have compassion for ourselves. We don't want to use this information to make ourselves miserable. Okay? All right. I'm going to give you some didactic stuff here. I don't want to go into this too much detail because I personally don't find it all that helpful, but you'll see it in the readings and stuff like that. In Tibetan Buddhism, or in Buddhism in general, we always talk about the two wings of the bird to enlightenment. You know, there's the wing of compassion and the wing of wisdom. So, you know, you can't, just because you can be nice, but you also need to be smart. And you can be smart, but you also need to be nice, you know? It's like that. So compassion and wisdom are the two wings of this bird that's going to take us to enlightenment. Now, there's some qualifications of a good student. I know I'm jumping all over the place, but what do you think some of the qualities of a good student are?
You trust the teacher?
That would be helpful, that you have some faith in the teachings and the teacher. Yeah. Yeah, some of the open-mindedness and this desire to learn exactly. Okay. All right. Well, this is what the texts say about it. All right. Free of preconceptions, willing to try new things on. Okay. So, but we all came in here with preconceptions, right? And so, for example, if you hear something about reincarnation or rebirth, but you've already decided that that's ridiculous, or that it's not possible, then you can't hear the teachings on the possibility of it. And there's a lot of things in Buddhism that I haven't experienced directly, and I'm sure Robbie would attest to this too, that teachings on karma, teachings on rebirth, all of these things, these teachings on emptiness sometimes are very hard to wrap our mind around, but it takes being open-minded. It takes being open-minded and being willing to sit with it. Even if you don't quite understand it, it's best not to just discard it. To be, and if we come in with a lot of preconceived notions, it will poison the teachings. That's the main point. Then the student needs to be intelligent, especially in a spiritual sense, and have high spiritual aspirations in life and are willing to work hard to reach them. Those are the three characteristics of a good student. Now, there's about 10 characteristics of a qualified teacher, and I'm not going to go into that because it's just kind of boring, but a qualified teacher is someone who knows more than you do, but it's also somebody who walks the talk. Somebody who has extensive understanding of the Dharma, of the teachings, has done extensive retreats, has made effort to realize not only just understanding the words, but the meaning behind the words and so on. So there's a lot that can be said about a qualified teacher. It's very, very difficult. There are 10 characteristics of a qualified teacher in the text, and it is very hard to find somebody with all of those characteristics. If we can find somebody with just half of those characteristics, we're doing pretty darn good. But we need a qualified teacher to make progress. And I'm not saying I am, by the way, but I feel like Geshe Gelug is definitely a qualified teacher. But you want somebody who's had extensive knowledge and teachings, and has had an opportunity to really work with the teachings and gain some realizations of them. This is interesting. I'll throw this out. A teaching which you decide to practice should have three distinguishing features. And this comes there's a good example of this in the text, where if you have one of those things where you make butter,
a churn,
yeah, and you're churning water, good luck. You're never going to get anything, are you? So if what we're studying is not true Dharma, we're never going to make any progress. So it's got to be the real deal. So here are some of the characteristics of the real deal. It should have been taught by the Buddha. It should have been cleansed of any errors. Sages must have brought the teachings to its authentic final form, having examined it to determine whether any wrong ideas crept into it after the Buddha taught it. And by the way, the Dalai Lama even says today, for example, there's some teachings in the Abhidharma, which is one of the teachings of the Buddha, that talk about the world being flat. And now, of course, we know the world, at least we don't think the world's flat, do we? Any flat world people here? There are some people like that. But anyway, we think of the world as round. So the Dalai Lama said, let's get rid of those. Those are not helpful. So if scientific examination and inquiry negates any of the teachings, then we should go for the truth, you know, not for just because it's written down. Then the last point he said is it should have brought true realizations to the hearts of master practitioners. Once they've heard, considered, and meditated upon it, then it must have passed to us through the various generations in an unbroken lineage. So this is a very interesting point, that these teachings, the Lam Rim teachings, the Buddha Dharma that we study here at Kadamba Center, it should have been taught by the Buddha. It should have been crunched by, you know, these great masters to make sure that the stuff that wasn't authentic has been purged. And then there should be practitioners who realize the meaning of the teachings and can pass those on from generation to generation in an unbroken lineage. And so this is what we claim, you know, is that as practitioners of Tibetan Buddhism and Buddhism in general, that the Dharma has come down from the Buddha to the present day through an unbroken lineage of students, disciples, and disciples becoming teachers who then teach their students, and so on like that up until today. So there's a big emphasis made on being part of an unbroken lineage. I don't know if that means anything to us as Westerners, because we're kind of skeptical, but it's a big deal for Tibetan practitioners that these teachings be authenticated by having been part of an unbroken lineage. And it's something to look into. Yeah, something to think about. Any questions so far? Yeah.
Is that unbroken lineage for all forms of Buddhism, you know?
I think it is. I'm pretty sure.
So they came to where the Buddha was and brought it back and just passed it on.
Yeah, because, you know, like the Theravada Buddha, I mean, the Mahayana includes all of the Theravada plus, we say that. It includes the teachings of the Hinayana plus the Mahayana. So, yeah, it's all come down to, you know, to the teachers in Thailand and Sri Lanka and Burma and like that. So we're basically caught, we talk about, you know, that one of the most powerful ways, in fact, this is the way, the principal way that renunciation is taught in Thailand, I'm pretty sure in Thailand, I'm not sure about other places, but is to teach about the wheel of life or samsara, okay? And to show people how we're caught in this process of uncontrolled causation, where, as some of us have had this experience, where we're just creatures of habit, you know, we take our past and we throw it in front of us and like walk right into it. And we do the same thing over and over and over again. Anybody have that experience? Yeah. And, you know, it's pretty disconcerting. We're caught in this. In Buddhism, it's this process of uncontrolled causation. The root of it is ignorance. Okay? Ignorance is more than not understanding, you know, mathematics or something like that. It's a misknowledge. It's a misunderstanding of the way things exist. That's what we ultimately mean in Buddhism, you know, by ignorance. So ignorance keeps this whole cycle of death, of life and going through life and dealing with all the different issues that we have to deal with, and then we die and then we get reborn, and we're caught in this process of uncontrolled causation from lifetime to lifetime, but also all day long, every day we do the same thing, don't we? It's not that hard to see it as, you know,
Yeah. Does somebody want to comment? Yeah, go ahead.
Another question.
Sure.
I'm pretty attracted to the idea, the bodhicitta motivation. It's something that makes sense to me. But with what you were saying about the qualities of a good teaching, it was my understanding, I could be mistaken, that the bodhicitta motivation as the supreme motivation didn't occur until Tibet, until Buddhism got to Tibet long after the Buddha was dead, the historical Buddha had died. So I was just wondering how the bodhicitta motivation, what that means about the Buddha needing to teach the concepts originally.
Yeah. That's a good question. You know, the only way, you can never know the answer to that, can you? However, you know, it's pretty clear that, for example, you know, these great masters that lived at Nalanda in India, you know, Chandrakirti, Shantideva, Nagarjuna, all of these great masters, you know, they were there long before Tibetan Buddhism flourished, and bodhicitta was a big part of the Dharma then. So, you know, it's interesting because in the Pali canon, they don't talk about it in the same way that they do in the Mahayana scriptures about it being like so important, and even talk about system, you know, ways, seven cause and effect, anyway, the different methods to develop it, because it's so important. We need to understand how to develop it. But you don't see that in Theravada Buddhism. But I know, you know, there are a lot of practitioners of the Theravada in this country that were some of the founders of this, you know, mindfulness movement that's so powerful in this country. Jon Kabat-Zinn, you know, being one of them, Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg, and blah, blah, blah. There's a whole lot of people like that. But a lot of those people have Tibetan teachers and really embraced bodhicitta as the motivation. This is what I've heard, don't know for sure, as a motivation for that practice, which is slightly different than the traditional Tibetan. But it's a good question. And, you know, I think... we just have to decide for ourselves. It's, you know, there's the sometimes it's called a lesser vehicle, the Hinayana, or Theravada. And I have to say, I mentioned this to somebody last week. When I lived in Thailand for 6 weeks at one point, and I was meditating at this monastery, trying to anyway, and I was talking to some of the monks. When I wasn't meditating, of course, and they were saying, oh yeah, you should give up the Mahayana, give up trying to get enlightened for all others. You should get just for yourself, you know, seek liberation for yourself. That's a great goal, and it is. But it's different. It's just a different goal. Whereas the Mahayana, the goal for the Mahayana is to help all living beings stop their suffering. All living beings, not just humans, but all living beings throughout all space and time, try to help them stop their suffering. The method to do that is to become enlightened. That's the enlightenment in and of itself, not the goal. The goal is to stop suffering. Enlightenment is the technique or the method to do that. So it's a different, it's called a universal vehicle because it excludes no one. Whereas the individual vehicle, Theravada, which, you know, but, you know, I mean, I can tell you, I met this one saint, I mean, he was said to be a saint, this Theravada saint called Ajahn Buddhadasa, and he's written many good, amazing books, and, that have, you know, whatever, and he's amazing, you know, he's just, he's totally dedicated to the welfare of others and helping his students and all students of the Dharma understand it and stop their suffering and help one another. So it's, sometimes it might even be a semantics game, but it's very specific. Developing bodhicitta is the rocket fuel for the Mahayana and absolutely necessary for safe, for practice of tantra. The three principles of the path are absolutely necessary to make any progress in the practice of tantra. So renunciation, bodhicitta, and correct view of emptiness are important. Yeah. Thank you for the question. Okay, so let's see. Here's a little quote. Renunciation is the true understanding that everything about your life is suffering. Whoa. Wait a minute. Not me. Not my life. If you don't believe that your life is suffering, you will not try to escape it. Once you've understood how you are suffering, you can think about how others must be suffering the same way. This then leads to the wish to free them from suffering and bring them to every happiness. So to develop this attitude of renunciation, if we read through this text, I'm going to back off here a minute, let's see how we're doing with time. So in the first little bit of this text, he's talking about he's saying the essential meaning of the victorious one, that's the Buddha's teachings. The path praised by all the holy victors and their children, the gateway of the fortunate ones desiring liberation. Liberation from what? Suffering. This I'll try to explain as much as I can. So this is Lama Tsongkhapa, who wrote this text. He's teaching this to one of his students, one of his special students. Those who are not attached to the pleasures of circling, okay, we're going to talk about this in just a second, who strive to make freedom and endowments meaningful, who entrust themselves to the path pleasing the victorious ones, you fortunate ones listen with a calm mind. So he's saying, if you're not attached to the pleasures of circling in samsara, and we are, aren't we? We are attached. You might not think about it. I'll put it to you. And we are attached. Is this still? Sorry. Let's see if I can get this thing to stay on me. Okay. I guess not. All right. So, you know, when we think about attachment, the word attachment sometimes gets a bad rap. The word attachment sometimes gets a bad rap because everything we're attached to is not necessarily a bad thing. The thing that's troublesome about attachment is that we cling. Anything we cling to is changing, isn't it? Everything we cling to is changing. So it's going to disappear. It's going to go out of existence. And we're going to be left dissatisfied. So these words almost use some in Buddhism, like the word attachment. You know, sometimes it's equipped with desire. You know, that's equated with clinging. And sometimes that's even equated with a more clinging and grasping would be like a more like, you know, clinging just a milder form of grasping. Can you think, anybody think of any other terms that we use?
Addiction,
yeah. you know, where the mind clings. Now, let me say a little bit about this term attachment, and all, the implication of all of these terms is that the nature of the mind is to project. If we see something desirable, use the example of another person, a person that we, that's, you know, drop dead gorgeous, okay, whatever that means to you. As soon as you see this person, you know, they look gorgeous to you, don't they? And you have no choice in the matter of saying, well, she's not that good looking or that cute or whatever. It's in front of us. And it looks like the gorgeousness comes from the side of the object, doesn't it? Like everybody in the world would see that person as gorgeous. But a dog might not, as we talked last week. Or their parents might not. They might say, well, she's my beautiful daughter, but, you know, I don't see her in the same way that somebody else might see her. So this, the tendency of the mind is to project on the things that we're attracted to or we're attached to. We exaggerate their positive qualities because we think they're coming from the side of the object. We exaggerate their positive qualities and we cling to them. Okay? So the problem is this exaggeration. We can appreciate a lovely person, an attractive person, a beautiful sunset or anything. But it's that exaggerating the positive qualities and clinging that creates the problems for us. Now, there's this teaching in Buddhism that, if those of you have been in any classes, I love this teaching, but it's, you know, generally speaking, we are, you know, when we talk about being caught in a, you know, where we're attached to everything that's delicious. Would everybody agree with that? We want deliciousness. This is Ajahn Buddhadasa's words. We're addicted to deliciousness. So, I'm going to use the word clinging here. We cling. We think this. So, four main categories of delicious things. One of them is actually stuff. We have objects. We attach to pleasure. I don't know what's going on with this thing. We're attached to pleasure. We're attached to a good reputation. Supposed to be the hardest one to give up, by the way. And we're attached to hearing nice words being said to us. What's another way to say that? Praise, yeah. We're attached to praise. We love to hear people. I sometimes I like to put down, no, praise is like, anyway, I'll figure it out in a minute. All right, so if we're attached to stuff, we have an aversion to what? Losing stuff. The more you crave your stuff, when you lose it, you suffer, right? So we, just by craving stuff, automatically we create an aversion to losing our stuff. All right? By the more we are addicted to pleasure, and you can see this in addicts of all types, the more we are addicted to pleasure, the more we have aversion to pain, right? The more we're attached to our good reputation, the more we suffer when we're disgraced. And the more, you know, we're attached to praise, the other word I was thinking about was approval, the more we suffer when we're disparaged, or what's another word? Praise, blame. Let's call it blame. Praise and blame. Sometimes I use the word blame, but the opposite of praise. Well, you get, well, I just say disapproval. What did you say?
Rejected.
Rejected, okay. Rejected. Disapproval. right. So you can see the list is limitless, but these are the general categories, things in life that we put all of our effort into, and we're a complete slave to this, by the way. And I invite you to look and see if this makes sense to you. We're a complete slave to our addiction, our craving for deliciousness. Now, here's the problem with this. There's nothing wrong with having stuff. Have I said that? Is there anything wrong with having great sex, great pleasurable experiences, great whatever it means to beautiful music, any kind of pleasurable good food, everything that we can think of? Did we say there's anything wrong with that? No. Is anything wrong with this or this? No. There's nothing wrong with having these sort of experiences that we consider to be positive. There is a problem, though, isn't it? When we cling to these, we suffer. That's the point. If we can experience, if we can have our stuff without clinging to it, if we can enjoy our pleasure without clinging to it, if we can have a good reputation without, you know, being addicted to having, you know, everybody like us or having a reputation or being praised, completely different experience. Now, if we're over here, In the middle, where we don't have either one, like I'm not losing anything because I don't have anything, right? So, are you happy here? As long as you crave this, you don't have it. You're not happy, are you? You're not. So, even in this sort of middle place. This place where you don't have it, is the craving creates suffering. Once you get it, you can't really enjoy it because we're so paranoid we're going to lose it. And then when we do lose it, we suffer even more. So we can see how it's not the... Is it possible to lose something and not suffer? Yeah. If we don't cling to it, we can lose stuff. We're all going to have to lose this life. We're going to lose this life. This body that we hold onto is so precious. We're going to have to say goodbye to this one day. Is it possible to die with a happy mind and be at peace and let go and not cling? Is it possible? I hope so. You know, but the Buddhists would say absolutely possible to die with a happy mind and let go. Is it possible to be in pain and not suffer? Is pain equal suffering? Not necessarily. We automatically think, oh, pain equals suffering. But we know people that have different thresholds of pain, don't we? Just a little pain, a drug addict. A heroin addict, you know, you lance their abscesses. I did this one time in San Francisco, as a matter of fact. I mean, they just can't stand any pain. But the Tibetans who live in, you know, at 20,000 feet, you know, you can, you know, treat, you know, they stick needles in them and they don't even flinch. The Eskimos are the same way, aren't they? They have such a high threshold for pain. They're not attached to pleasure. So they can take pain and so forth. So we all know that. And is this part of life? Absolutely. We cannot go through life without losing things, experiencing pain, being disgraced, and getting other people's disapproval. No way to get away from it. And as long as we cling, we're going to suffer. We're just going to be on this roller coaster of suffering. And I don't want to be, you know, we don't want that, do we? We don't want it. So, this is not a hopeless case, though, because the answer is what? Stop clinging. But then you go, well, how do you do that? Stick around. That's what this is about, isn't it? Letting go is not so easy to do. I mean, it might be easy to let go. Like, if, you know, somebody pulls in front of you in traffic, you know, and you get a little ticked off at them. You know, well, I've done that to somebody else. Okay. But you know, if somebody like runs off with your spouse, it's going to be a little bit harder to let go of that one, isn't it? The anger and the, you know, the hatred and the whatever you might feel. Or somebody harms your child, for gosh sakes, that would be horrible. So, all right. So you fortunate ones listen with a calm mind, without a complete intention. Here he's saying the third line. Without the complete intention, definitely to be free from circling. Samsara, okay? There's no way to pacify attachment seeking the pleasurable effect of the ocean of circling. So that's exactly what we're talking about now. Without renunciation, there's no way to pacify attachment, our addiction to deliciousness in our world. Also, by craving for a cyclic existence, embodied beings are continuously bound. Therefore, at the very beginning, renunciation. So he's saying, basically saying that we are bound from lifetime to lifetime, as long as we're caught in this process. This one's worse than the other one. Yeah, I don't know what to stand there. But anyway, as long as we're caught in this process of uncontrolled causation called samsara, we're gonna things are not going to go well. And so renunciation is and we haven't really gone into the next week. We'll go into a lot more about the subject of dukkha, and really take a look at our lives from the perspective of a Buddhist mind scientist, you know, and see, is this does this make sense? Which one of these teachings moves my mind and like that? So, you know, but we have to have compassion for ourselves. To do that, we have to realize that we're suffering, and to do that, we have to study suffering. We have to understand the depths of it. Also, to have compassion for others. You know, compassion for ourselves, compassion for others really depends upon understanding how extensive and pervasive suffering is. And again, this is not to depress us, but we're actually describing what the Buddha is claiming we can be free of. Okay? So we're talking about what we can be free of. If we couldn't be free of it, there would be no point in sitting around talking about it, would it? It would just be depressing. Here, I'm going to tell you about how miserable your life is and is going to be, and then, you know, no, that's not helpful. So the Buddha is actually describing that which we can get beyond. Now, we're going to go into just two quick points tonight, and then that help to develop renunciation. The first part of this, line number 4, where it says, freedom and endowments are difficult to find, and life has no time to spare. By gaining familiarity with this, attraction to the appearances of this life is reversed. Now, let's read that again. Now, freedom and endowments. So what are we free from? You know, there's a teaching, the 8 freedoms and the 10 endowments, but I'm not going to bore you with that. You can go read about it if you want to, but you know, in a real sense, we're free from having imperfect senses. We're free from being born in Syria or someplace like that, where we wouldn't have the opportunity, the freedom, to come here. We're not born in some place where we wouldn't have an opportunity to practice. We have a mind that's interested in spiritual matters and in spiritual growth and trying to learn something about more about it. So these 8 freedoms and then the endowments are things like, you know, we're born at a time when the Buddhist teachings exist. We're born at a time when there are people that have actually put the teachings into practice and have realized the teachings, and they're willing to teach us the teachings. And we're born at a time when we have the leisure and fortune to be able to practice. So it's a special opportunity, I guess, is one way to look at it. You know, some people, one example one teacher gave is sort of like throughout, well, I'll give you the example they use in the text sometimes. Two good examples about how precious this life is, this precious human life that we have, and how rare it is. It's said that if there's this golden yolk that's floating on the surface of the ocean, of this vast ocean, it's just like one of these things that you rescue people with, but it's a yolk, and is floating on the ocean, and beneath the ocean is a blind turtle. And every 100 years, you know, turtles need to breathe, right? So every 100 years, this blind turtle, who can't see, of course, he's blind, he comes up for a little air, and then goes right back down again. What are the chances of that blind turtle poking his head up through that golden yolk? Pretty rare. Pretty unlikely. What are the chances of you taking a handful of pickup sticks and throwing them on the ground and having it spell your name perfectly? Pretty rare. Pretty unlikely. Same kind of examples like this. So you know, it is a precious life, the opportunity that we have, and it's rare, and it's difficult to create the causes for it. The causes for this life are praying to have a human rebirth, but the hardest causes are really practicing ethics, living ethically. That's the main, you know, one of the principal cause for having a human rebirth. Again, we're trying to look at these two meditations, these two contemplations. One is, you know, we have freedom and endowments, difficult to find. Freedom and endowments, difficult to find. And the second one is, this life has no time to spare. This life has no time to spare. Now, how many of us think we're going to die? Now, how many of you really think you're going to die? I don't believe it. I think we know we're going to die intellectually, but there's a part of us that thinks we're going to live forever. Think about that. There's a part of us that feels enduring, you know, it's going to live forever no matter what. It's going to, you know, there's a part of me that won't die, you know, and I'm not, you know, I'm going to die, but it won't happen today. That kind of mind. I've looked at this in my own mind, and I think I have to say, I still, even intellectually, I know I'm going to die. There's a part of me that just doesn't believe it yet. And I've talked to other people that I respect that say, I think you might be onto something there. But you know, death is definite. We're all going to die. Nobody lives forever. So death is definite, right? Tick tock, even while we're here, from you exhale, you inhale, exhale, inhale. You're going to run out of air one day. One day you're going to exhale, then you're not going to inhale. Then somebody's going to say, you're dead. That's right. That's going to be like that for all of us. With every passing tick of the clock brings us closer to the time of death. So it is going to happen, and we have to come to terms with that. So, from a Buddhist perspective, we go, death is definite, and we do meditations to try to convince ourselves of this, not just intellectually, but really feel that this is going to happen, and I need to get in touch with the fact that my life will come to an end, and so I must practice the Dharma, because that's really what's going to help. Okay, and then the second point is that death could happen at any moment. You know, could happen any second. Could happen tonight. Could happen, you know, any moment. There's so many things that we have in our lives that are to protect us, don't we? That could kill us. this building could, you know, be the source of our demise if a tornado came over right now. Well, the medicine that your doctor gave you this morning, you could have an anaphylactic reaction to it tonight and die. Or the nice car that you drove here could end up, you know, in a head-on collision on the way home. There's so many, even the things that we have that are supposed to make our lives more leisurable often become the cause of our demise. Bad food, bad medicine, and just little blood clots, little tiny blood clots, or little cells that go berserk and turn into tumors and kill us. You know, something's going to kill us. You know, so and it's going to happen, and we have no idea when it's going to be. So we need to get in touch with that. We need to get in touch with death is definite, and the time of death, it could be any moment. Now, how could that be of help to you as a spiritual practitioner? Let's do it now. Let's don't put it off till tomorrow. Let's do it now. Let's put our effort into practicing and transforming our mind now, because tomorrow may never come. Tomorrow may be the next life. And then the last point is that death is definite. The time of death is indefinite. And the only currency, this is an investment course, by the way, the only currency that you can spend at the time of death is what? Spiritual currency, yeah. The imprints, the realizations that you placed on your mind, those, you know, compassion, kindness, wisdom, you know, the good things that you've done for others, you know, your ability to stay calm and think about others and do a practice as you're dying where you're taking on, like Christ did on the cross, taking on the suffering of the world, giving everlasting happiness, and, you know, giving beings what they want. That's called, in Buddhism, we call that Tonglen. We'll do that meditation. You know, so death is definite. The time of death is indefinite. And the only thing that's of any help at the time of death is Dharma practice. So we must practice the Dharma. We must practice it now. We must practice it purely. Just take a message, okay? So, here we go. Freedom endowments are difficult to find, and life has no time to spare. Could be over any moment. By gaining familiarity with this, attraction to the appearances of this life is reversed. Something to think about. Does it? Your life is precious. Could be over any minute. Really, really precious. Hard to come by. Almost impossible to get another human life. Almost impossible. And could be over any minute. And the only thing of any benefit is the spiritual currency, the spiritual imprints that we put on our mind. We better do something. You know, it does turn the mind away from the attraction to the appearances of this life. They're reversed. Does it or doesn't it? It's a question. But it can do that. If we do these meditations well, then all this delicious stuff we realize is just, it entraps us. You know, it prevents us from making spiritual progress. And not the stuff, but the addiction, the attraction, the clinging to the stuff. And so again, thinking about this, life is precious. It's so hard to come by. And it could be over any minute. It could be over any second. And I must practice the Dharma, and I must practice it now and purely. That turns the mind. And this is the way we develop renunciation, by the way. This is how we turn our mind away from just seeking the pleasures of this life. The next week we'll do the meditations on karma. And we'll spend a lot of time talking about karma, because that's such a great subject. And there's a whole module on karma in Discovering Buddhism. And we'll talk about dukkha in a lot of different ways, ways that hopefully you'll find helpful. So we got about 3 minutes to go. So there's I like to do a digestion meditation. you know, there's a lot that's been said, and if you find something that resonates, you know, that has moved your mind in a positive way, hopefully, if you find something like that, just allow those thoughts that are useful to percolate up and maybe make some determination to use that information to help your mind. Let's read, we're going to read through the rest of this text, starting on the sixth line, sixth stanza. Purpose of generating the mind of enlightenment, that's bodhicitta. Even if renunciation has been developed, if it is not possessed by the mind of enlightenment, it does not become the cause of the perfect bliss of unsurpassed enlightenment. Therefore, the wise generate the supreme mind of enlightenment. Swept away by the current of four powerful rivers, tied by the tight bonds of karma so hard to undo, caught in the iron net of self-grasping, completely enveloped by the total darkness of ignorance, endlessly reborn in cyclic existence, ceaselessly tormented by the three sufferings, thinking that all mothers are in such a condition, generate the supreme mind of enlightenment. If, like the mother whose cherished son has fallen into a pit of fire and who experiences even one second of his suffering as an unbearable eternity, your reflection on the suffering of all mother sentient beings has made it impossible for you to bear their suffering for even one second, and the wish seeking enlightenment for their sake arises without effort, then you have realized the precious, my precious mind of enlightenment. Without the wisdom realizing ultimate reality, even though you've generated renunciation in the mind of enlightenment, you cannot cut the root cause of circling. Therefore, attempt the method to realize dependent arising. One who sees the cause and effect of all phenomena of both cyclic existence and the state beyond sorrow as forever unbetraying, and for whom any object trusted in by the grasping mind has completely disappeared, has at that time entered the path pleasing the Buddhas. If the appearance of dependent relation, which is unbetraying, is accepted separately from emptiness, and as long as they are seen as separate, then one has still not realized the Buddha's intent. If these two realizations are happening simultaneously without alternation, and for merely seeing dependent relations completely unbetraying, the definite ascertainment comes that completely destroys the way all objects are apprehended as truly existent. At that time, the analysis of the ultimate view is complete. Furthermore, appearance eliminates the extreme of existence, and emptiness eliminates the extreme of non-existence. If you realize how emptiness manifests in the manner of cause and effect, you're not captivated by wrong notion holding extreme views. In this way, you realize exactly the vital points, the three principal aspects of the path, resort to seeking solitude, generate the power of effort, and quickly accomplish your final goal, my child. And then what page is that dedication prayer on? On page 246, we'll do a dedication prayer. So dedication is like, we talked a little bit about it, but it's like some positive energy's been created tonight individually and collectively, and so we want to basically send that energy out to benefit not only ourselves but all living beings. So we dedicate. This is kind of a famous dedication prayer. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvest. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Okay, thank you. I think we need some help rearranging the room. Is that right? So there's... Pardon?
Do you have any additional homework or anything?
Just keep reading and doing... if you do a meditation on those two points that we talked about, the freedoms and endowments and death and impermanence, basically. And that just that little bit there is a good place to start. If you can remember this stuff too, that would be good to contemplate.